This is A Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris Perry.
We do not talk about race and racism in this country. We talk about it, but the people at the table are speaking different languages and no one understands each other. They're not getting to any solutions. The talk is just talk. It's not solution-based talk.
That was Zanetta Everhart, mother of Zaire Goodman, a 20-year-old employee of Tops Friendly Market in East Buffalo, New York. Goodman was shot in the neck on Saturday, but survived the deadly massacre carried out by a gunman who appears to have been motivated by white supremacy. The point made by Everhart is key. We've heard the official response to acts of racial terror before. This is not who we are as a nation. We're better than this. Elected officials, including President Joe Biden and New York Governor Kathy Hochul, have not hesitated to call the Buffalo massacre an act of white supremacy. But the governor's response also has focused on how the shooter obtained a gun and why he was able to live stream his deadly rampage on Twitch for roughly 2 minutes. Now, these elements of this shooting are important to address, but in some ways they obscure how these acts of racial terror carried out in the 21st century are the latest chapter in the violent, hate-filled history of our nation. The Buffalo shooting is not entirely unique to 2022. In fact, it recalls a spate of racist attacks that took place more than a century ago, in the summer of 1919.
Everything happened in the summer of 1919. When we look at the landscape of current events, particularly the volatile, weaponized forms of racial hatred, culminating in events like the massacre in Buffalo, 1919 looks like a preface.
This is historian Jelani Cobb, a staff writer at The New Yorker and the incoming dean of the Columbia School of Journalism. I turned to him to provide some much-needed context into this weekend's horrific shooting. We begin in the red summer of 1919.
In that summer, we saw mass attacks on Black people in cities across the country, and in reaction to a number of dynamics, including the nascent Great Migration, Black people gaining a foothold in employment and industrial sectors, et cetera, and an attempt to literally beat them back into submission. And, you know, we talk about the Red Summer of 1919, but it's really kind of shorthand for the entire era. The East St. Louis massacre happened in 1917, and the Elaine, Arkansas, massacre happened in 1921. And, Tulsa happened in 1921. And so it was a intense time period in which we saw an upswing of racial violence directed at Black communities.
Given that you are a historian who can so readily access that history, are you surprised when moments like 2019, when a gunman targeted El Paso, Texas's Latino community, or just this week, when an 18-year-old white man drives to Buffalo, New York, and kills 10 people, most of them Black, in a grocery store?
I'm not surprised. And I think we could throw into that 2015, when Dylan Roof, who was 21 years old, massacred 9 people in the basement of the church in Charleston, South Carolina. The attack at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh in 2018. And so I think we've seen this pattern frequently enough to be able to recognize, the details of it, And one of the things that was particularly notable, is that now, the manifesto has become, the accessory du jour for the mass murderer. They all pen, these badly written screeds about racial jeopardy and the need to defend white people. That's what one of the common themes we saw in everything left behind by these killers in each of those instances. And so I think that both in the sense of the history, the grand sweep of history in the United States, and in the sense of the immediate pattern we've seen in the last decade, there's no real way to be surprised at any of this, not if you've been paying the least bit of attention.
Now, when you take us back to 2015, to Charleston, South Carolina, that is distinct from the other three that you named, from Tree of Life and from El Paso and from what just happened in Buffalo, in that all of those, the last three, occur after Donald Trump has been elected president of the United States. 2015 happens while Barack Obama is still president of the United States, and many would have us believe that the violence that we're seeing right now is a result of Donald Trump. Is that short-sighted?
It is. Just as a kind of historical footnote, I would add that Trump declared his candidacy the day before Dylann Roof killed the people in the church. And, you know, there was a notable overlap in the themes. You know, everyone remembers that Trump said that he was running for president because of the scourge of Mexican rapists. And during the midst of the, you know, macabre shooting scene in the basement of the Emmanuel AME Church, when one of the victims, a young man by the name of Tywanza Sanders, questioned Dylann Roof about why he was doing what he was doing, they said that, you know, there's no need to do this. We mean you no harm. He said, "You all are raping our women." And so we heard the language of, you know, the defense of presumably white women at the hands, from threats posed at the hands of men of color, deployed twice within 24 hours or so. And, you know, vastly different contexts. But we heard that language kind of ricocheting around in the zeitgeist. And so Donald Trump is not, he has a relationship to Trumpism that Joe McCarthy had to McCarthyism, which is that there was this phenomenon. It was taking place throughout the country in this disparate way. And Joe McCarthy simply recognized it and attached his name, became the most visible purveyor of something that was already happening, you know, which is the kind of red baiting and suppression of free speech, et cetera. And the same thing with Trump. Like, we see this kind of racial nationalist rhetoric that's come to the fore in the aftermath of him being elected to the presidency, but by no means did it originate with him.
So what is different? What is unique, not necessarily better, but different about this 21st century violence than the 20th century violence that you've pointed us to?
Well, certainly the context of it is different. And what I mean by that is that Dylann Roof was reacting to the existence of a black president. The 1919 iteration of this was happening in attempts to prevent black people from even being able to participate in any form of civic life, from being able to vote, from being able to own property, from being able to exercise the most basic tenets of citizenship. And so I think, you know, those things are different. Obviously, the capacity to disseminate this information, you know, through the internet and via social media, you know, that is different. You know, the mechanisms of, you know, the kind of dispersal here, even though, you know, there's been one thing that's been interesting. People have made the comparison of live streaming these attacks to the way that people made photos of lynchings and disseminated those through the mail. But nonetheless, I think that the internet has amplified this and multiplied it, you know, by an exponent. And so, you know, that's different. I would also say, and, you know, I say this whenever people are talking, understandably, you know, in despairing tones, that we have a community, despite the titanic obstacles confronting us, we have a community that has never been better positioned to respond to them. And, you know, by that, I mean a community of people of conscience, a community of African Americans, you know, a community of people who believe in democracy and who are prepared to wage the kind of protracted struggle that it will take to actually, you know, prevent these kind of things in the future.
Can we talk a bit about exactly that community? I suppose one of the things that's always held a certain kind of morbid fascination for me about the period that for me, growing up in the South, I was taught was called the Redemption, right? The period that at the end of Reconstruction was an idea of people having achieved a thing, having accomplished a thing, having come to a space of freedom, of some level of participation and civic engagement, and then having it taken, right? And I've wondered often what it must feel like in one's gut to actually experience that. You know, we can see the advance and decline, but to actually experience it. And I gotta say, between the leaked opinion from the Supreme Court around abortion rights and this racial violence, that as a Black woman, I'm beginning to not have to wonder anymore. I'm beginning to feel that sense of having achieved and then having it taken.
Yeah, I think that's very real. And I think that also, quite frankly, at the dawn of the Trump era, I had to check myself personally, because we have, I think, in my estimation, we've had the kind of relationship to freedom that, you know, the stereotypical trust fund baby has to wealth. You know, we have benefited so tremendously from the work of a previous generation. You know, we had struggles, we had things we had to do, but the rudiments, the fundamentals were in place, you know, because of the work that had been done before us. And we're now in a place where we actually have to get out and secure that future for ourselves, or regain that future for ourselves and for generations that come after us. And it's a sobering awareness. And by no means do I think we can like underestimate the scale of the work that is in front of us.
It is common in this moment, and we certainly have heard it from many political leaders, to offer an aspirational narrative of the American project, and to say that moments like this massacre in Buffalo, is not who we are, that America is something different than this. And then there's a kind of pushback that says, no, this absolutely is who we are, that the history of the United States is written in blood, from settler colonialism to intergenerational chattel bondage on forward. Do you see a role for an aspirational narrative, one that acknowledges that bloody past, but also somehow says, maybe we could be better than this?
Mm-hmm. I think we're heir to that legacy. You know, the thing that I think of is, you know, those civil rights marches where people are carrying the American flag. Now, one of the things that it's important for us to bear in mind, just as a honest reality, is that the flag of the Confederacy, for the time that it flew, you know, over, you know, the 4-year existence of the Confederacy, was the banner under which countless atrocities were committed against African Americans, people of African descent. But that American flag was witness to those atrocities for decades longer than that, from 1776 to 1865, and that's not if we count Jim Crow. And so we have to be real about what has happened here. And at the same token, those people marching in Selma, those people marching in Montgomery, you know, those people being bludgeoned, carried the American flag. They were aware of that disparity. They were aware of what that flag had borne witness to. But they were carrying it in an attempt to redefine what it was and redefine what it meant. And so I think that it's not fence sitting to say that both of those things are part of the American tradition, and that we're engaged now in a dire existential conflict about which of those traits will be the defining one when we look at that flag and what it represents.
Jelani Cobb, staff writer at The New Yorker and the incoming dean at the Columbia School of Journalism. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.